grab your pitchfork, light your torch, and get ready for inciting a riot. Conventional thinking has been warned, because we're going to gather, and we're going to march, and we're going to blow its f***ing house down.
Hello, rioters, and welcome back to Inciting a Riot, the podcast. I would be your left-wing, dirt-worshipping host, Firelight. Today, episode 147, Inciting a Pandemic Riot, part one, part uno. I have a very special guest returning to the show, Corey Hutchison. You might know the guy. He is the co-host of New World Witchery, a podcast I'm sure you all know and love. More than mine. He is here today to talk with me about the history of pandemics. This is actually a conversation that a few guys have asked to have, and I didn't feel that I alone would be able to do the topic justice. So I called up my good friend Corey Hutchison and said, hey, I have this idea for a show. And he said, hey, this sounds like a riot. we decided that we would get together on Father's Day, no less. He gave up a few hours of his Father's Day to come and have a very long conversation with me about the social and folkloric history of pandemics. We talk about the Black Plague. We talk about Salem, the satanic panic of the 80s, AIDS. We get into like Ebola, H1N1, and a few other things. It was a very long conversation lasting very nearly 2.5 hours. And I figured I wouldn't dump the whole thing on you because that is quite a lot to ask you to listen to all at once. So the show is getting broken up into two parts. This is part one. Part two will come out in 2 weeks. Of course, if you are a Patreon supporter for as little as a dollar, you get to go ahead and listen to everything, all of it. And at the $5 level, you get to watch us talk at each other and watch me scramble around and click on tabs so that I can sound like I'm a lot smarter of a person than I am. I do want to give a little bit of a disclaimer here because the trouble with talking about these topics is that any one of these pandemics, any one of these issues could be an entire podcast, not just a podcast episode, but an entire podcast, in-depth research-oriented podcast in its own right, talking about Salem, talking about the AIDS crisis, talking about the Satanic Panic, talking about the Black Plague. All of those things are very, very big, complex, sticky, complicated issues. And it gets sticky when you try to talk about them in a shortened format. So I just kind of want to make you guys aware, we are aware that each of these topics is presented in a fairly truncated manner. And if we didn't get to your pet thing about the issue, believe me, it wasn't for lack of trying. But there are some nuanced pieces, especially in part two when we get to the AIDS epidemic, that we very much tried to get to, but we couldn't obviously get to everything. So I do encourage you, I'm going to be putting some resources, at least some of the resources that I used in my own research for this show, in the show notes on incitingariot.com. I do encourage you to go do some further reading. I hope this sparks some further reading for you and some further research. But gosh, I'm going to quit talking now because this is a super long episode and we're going to start like several hundred years ago and work our way forward. So I'm not going to talk anymore. I'm going to turn the microphone over to, well, myself and Corey. Corey Hutchison, welcome to Inciting a Riot.
Thank you. Glad to be here again.
Again. I was going to look up, but then I didn't because I'm old and I don't have to anymore. I feel like we've done several shows together. I don't remember the last time we actually did a show together. I think people in their heads think that we've do them all the time because people are, oh, I can't wait for you guys to do something again. I've gotten that. When's the next time you guys are going to do something? 2014? Is that right?
I feel like it might be 2014, 2015 since I was on your show.
I was gonna say, yeah, you did pop on. We did do an Inciting a Brouhaha. So that's
exactly
something.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So that's something. Well, welcome back to Inciting a Riot. It's been a hot minute since you and I have just chatted, sir.
Yeah.
How are you? Happy Father's Day.
Thank you very much. Happy fur baby Father's Day to you. So I don't know if Keek is there or not.
She is. She's right here. Oh, God. First question, of course, how are you doing during this quarantine? It's what, we're in week 13 now of lockdown?
Yeah, depending on kind of where you are in the country. I'm doing well on a lot of fronts. I am a bastion of unspeakable amounts of privilege in so many ways. So there's a lot of kind of insulation that I've had from needing to feel the consequences of the pandemic. So for example, I work in higher education. That means that we went online. That was a scramble and it was difficult, but it's nowhere near as difficult as, for example, so many of my students, I have students who are working in healthcare. One student who is on sort of a pre-med degree, and works in health. And then her father, contracted COVID, and died this semester. And so, you know, she's dealing with both the being on the front lines of this and also having a parent, die from this disease. So, relatively speaking, you know, I've got students who are frontline workers in grocery stores as well. There are so many of them that are dealing with so much more than I am dealing with. And so for that, you know, I'm incredibly privileged that I get to, you know, remote work and do my work from home. I can, you know, work in the comfort of my office, stay isolated, stay secure, you know, wear my mask when I'm going out to the grocery store, and everything's kind of hunky-dory for me. So on that end, I'm okay. You know, mental health wise, I think everybody is probably a little strained at this point, everywhere. And I think that's difficult. But otherwise I'm doing fairly well. What about yourself?
I'm okay. It was a little difficult. You and I both live fairly far north. If I remember correctly, so the early couple of months of quarantine were no fun because, you know, no going outside, no going anywhere, no at all. And, where I live out on this ranch in the south suburbs of Chicago, I don't really have much in the way of like neighbors or stuff that I could have gone and done. So, I think I could probably still count on both hands the number of times I really have like left my house. And all this time, I'm a very social creature. I don't know if you've realized. So I'm climbing the walls just a tad, mm-hmm. just a little bit of a tad. And one of my dear friends, she did book reviews for Inciting a Riot, Vinna, mm-hmm. and I have decided that now is the time to write a novel, mm-hmm. because why not? So that's something that we've been doing. We get together every Sunday to sort of go over what we did the week prior. And last Sunday before, it had been a couple of months into quarantine when we decided we would start seeing each other, say, once a week. And we're like, well, you've been in quarantine. I've been in quarantine. I will take this calculated risk with you. Mm-hmm. I will be fine with that. But we decided to go to our little downtown area and sit and have some coffee and catch up on our writing and stuff, and got in my car, drove downtown, nary a mask in sight, everybody just prancing about, mm-hmm. on the sidewalks as though nothing were happening. So just turned right back around, came back to my house, opened a bottle of wine, and did it on my porch. So, mm-hmm. did the writing on the porch, nothing else.
And the bottle of wine, I think.
And the bottle of wine. So it's, you know, I am certainly somebody that's raring to get back to some kind of normalcy or what my normal would look like. I am also in a very privileged position in that I have continued to work during this time. I'm in the financial world, and that doesn't sleep, that doesn't take breaks, and it's been an interesting few months.
to be in that world. But I'm very lucky, very blessed. And I have to say that because of this pandemic, they had always talked about a lot of our jobs being able to be done from home, but never actually did anything to make those jobs workable mm-hmm. from home. And then suddenly there's now this long-term plan that most of us will start permanently working from home. So I may have ended up lucking into a permanent work from home position, which would certainly save me a lot of time and money. But it's, I really don't like the way that it happened, obviously.
Mm. See, that would cut into my podcast and audiobook listening time, because I do listen in the car quite a lot, but I know what you mean.
Oh, see, but then there's I actually get a lot more of them read and listened mm-hmm. to, because there's the walks with the dogs, there's the going out for the runs, there's the mm-hmm. listening while I'm outside working out, there's the, oh my gosh, I have almost completed my annual challenge for my annual reading challenge for myself. Uh-huh. So I'm going to have to like double the number of books or something, because I'm getting a lot of them done now.
That's good.
Which is nice. But the really nice thing, and I can tell that sort of my own anxiety levels are starting to decrease, because I'm not just doing audiobooks anymore. I'm actually able to pick up and read a real book start to finish, which is something that I don't think I've had the stillness to sit and do for quite a long time. So that's been nice. So speaking of, this is crazy. And I don't know if you're prepared to talk about something like this, but like, speaking of pandemics,
mm-hmm.
what do you say we like go over the entire recorded modern history of pandemics? Like
give
together,
it a shot.
Like right now.
And give it a shot. Why not?
So you and I have been talking about going over just sort of some highlights, some big notes, some top shelf stuff about the history of pandemics as and their intersections with folklore and mm-hmm. and social science and sociology, the way that they've affected a society. And we decided that we were going to hit on a few of the big ones, going all the way back to the Black Plague. We were also going to talk about Salem, and then jump forward in time a little bit, talk about Satanic Panic, and then some of the more medically related ones, HIV, AIDS, Ebola, the various Asiatic flus of the early aughts. So let's dive in, sir.
All right. I think we should. It's funny because you mentioned the sort of the idea of the Black Plague, right? Which is, I think, where when people think of pandemics, that's where they sort of drop a pin. They say that's the first big plague. But I mean, this is nothing new. Pandemics have existed essentially as long as humans have clustered together in groups. You can go back to the sort of late Roman antiquity period, and you have the Antonine Plague, right? So this is a long, I don't want to call it a long-standing tradition of dying in massive numbers, because that's awful. But it is something that we've had to deal with as a sort of collective body for a very long time. And I think we've come up with some interesting strategies for trying to control and deal with that over time, which are varying levels of effectiveness. But I guess, it's starting with the Black Plague makes the most sense, because it's probably the one where if you're talking about plagues, right, that's the big one. That's the one that sort of looms large over sure. everybody's mind. You've got a third of the population of Europe kind of gone by the end of this, right? So what do you want to say about that? Where do we go with that?
Well, and the interesting thing is that you say, the Black Plague wasn't anything. It's not new, right? Mm-hmm. It's not, the Black Plague, Black Death, the plague, just whatever you want to call it. It wasn't anything new technically to recorded history. And it's not actually the first time that this particular virus killed a whole bunch of people. Researchers found that even as far back as like 3000 BC, a version mm-hmm. of the virus that caused what's known as the Black Death or Black Plague killed off a whole bunch of early man somewhere around like 3000 BC. So they have now dubbed the Black Plague the Second Plague. which I thought was interesting. But for me, and I like that you say, you know, we sort of start there, you know, when we talk about the modern understanding of Black Death, Black Plague, whatever, of pandemics, we sort of start there. And in my mind, I don't know, once you get to into talking about history, sometimes for me, it's just, it's all happened a long time ago. Just everything happened a long time ago. So for me, I try to figure out, like, when exactly, like in my head, contextualizing the beginnings of the Black Plague, like what does humanity look like at that time? And I thought it was really interesting. So the Black Plague, the heyday of the plague, occurred between 1346 and 1353, which was actually over 100 years before the first book was printed. Which I just thought was an interesting thing to note. The first book was printed by Guggenheim in 1455. And it was actually about 10 years into the Hundred Years' War. So Europe is in turmoil. There's a whole bunch of bad happening. There's a big war that's going to last for a century. And we get this plague that comes in. And there are a lot of reasons for it. There's shipping, there's rats, there's all sorts of, you know, causes for it. But the reason why it spreads so terribly much is, you know, a misunderstanding of disease, just a complete misunderstanding of you know, how diseases spread and what a disease is and things like that. One article that I was looking at said, because they did not understand the biology of the disease, many people believe that the Black Death was a kind of divine punishment, retribution for sins against God, such as greed, blasphemy, heresy, fornication, and worldliness. Some believed that you needed to win God's forgiveness in order to get rid of it. So, unfortunately, because of this, there was a purge of what people considered heretics and other troublemakers. So thousands of Jews were massacred in 1348 and 1349, whereas thousands more fled to sparsely populated regions of Eastern Europe where they could be safe. So talk to me a little bit about, I know that you did a phenomenal work on your own blog, at New World Witchery. Talk to me a little bit about the spiritual aspects of the Black Plague. What are we looking at spiritually there?
Right. Well, and so you bring up you're talking about the 14th century Black Plague, and it's important to note there's actually, when we think about the European Black Plague, there's kind of two iterations of it. And so you have the 14th century one, you also have a 17th century one, which is one that we have some really good records about. And so the 14th century one, as you're saying, like there's this persecution of what's seen as heresy. By the 17th century, you're kind of beginning to step into the Enlightenment age, right? And so people are taking these, what they're thinking of as sort of scientific approaches to disease, even though they're often sort of dealing with kind of folk science or folk medicine in some way. And so really kind of at both ends of that, you have people who are making it, like, so if you look at some of the letters kind of going back and forth between, bishops, for example, during, the 14th century, you see a lot of like internal hand-wringing over, you know, well, wait a second, you know, is this, a divine punishment, or is this, you know, a divine test, right? It's like, is this something where, you know, we're being asked to step in and do something, specific, and it's not a punishment. It's just a mortification of the flesh, so to speak. Right. While, you also have, plenty of people who don't necessarily see it that way. They see it as, you know, one of those uncontrollable things that is impacting everybody, but that is not the dominant mindset, because the cosmological worldview at the time is that there's cause and effect for everything, right? Sort of the imposed religious structure of the time says, if if something happens on Earth, it is because it is reflecting something happening in heaven and vice versa. So if you are suffering on Earth, there is a spiritual component to your affliction in most cases. And in the 14th century, that's still a very dominant mindset. It's this idea of sort of unified cosmology, which by the 17th century is a little more fragmented. And so it's interesting because in the 14th century, a lot of like what you're saying, a lot of the sort of cures are very religiously oriented, right? Involving certain types of prayer. Funnily enough, it's, you know, getting people together in the churches, which is probably not the best solution, you know, in a pandemic situation. So you have, you know, you have people going.
Let's all get together in the church and touch each other's faces. Let's just touch each other's face. Let's have a face touching party.
Yeah. And to be fair, like they're not, they're, you know, them getting together, having bubonic plague is not necessarily going to, it's not spread quite the same way as COVID is spreading.
No.
Right? But there's, you know, we know now fleas are a huge component here, right? Fleas are a huge component of why this is spreading. And they have fleas. So the fleas are changing hands, so to speak, in these close quarters. By the 17th century, you see some really interesting things kind of happening with this version of the Black Plague. One of the primary sources we have for seeing this in London, for example, is Samuel Pepys' diary. Where he's talking about, he talks about pretty much everything that goes on in the world at that point in time. But you can see people are trying to take on more control. They're trying to establish more personal control. So at night they're burning these bonfires in the streets because they believe that the fire will purify the bad air, right? The malaria of disease, right? This is where we get another one of our pandemic names. So they're using the fire to purify it. Pepys's solution to a lot of problems is essentially smoke and drink until I can't feel anything. And that seems to be pretty effective. Tobacco is seen sometimes as a curative, so that's a part of that. They imposed a really interesting curfew, which is at night, healthy people are supposed to stay indoors while the unhealthy people are then allowed to circulate at night because it's thought that they can purge from themselves this diseased air into this sort of bad air of night, right? So, you know, in a way, they're coming up with some really novel solutions, which is, hey, we should quarantine the people that are sick. And they do that by marking red X's on or red crosses on the door of the people who are quarantined, keeping them separate from everybody else. And then we're going to separate the healthy and the sick so that they're not in the same spaces at the same time. We're going to use fire to try to, you know, kill whatever this disease is, which, you know, heat can kill.
I was going to say, it's not the dumbest idea.
Right.
It's not the best application. Yeah, it's not the right application of that idea, but it's not the worst idea.
Right. Like you're in the ballpark, but you're. But for some reason, you're in the bleachers and swinging at the chairs. So, okay. And so I know that's a sports metaphor. Sport. I don't know if that's going to go.
I got the sports. It's fine. Jinx. I'll forget you.
That's the only sports metaphor you're going to get out of me, I think.
Okay. Later, we're going to talk about HIV AIDS. So I'm going to get like a lot of gay references. So don't worry.
Fair enough. And so, but yeah, it is really interesting. Like they're doing these things that you know, they're trying to take control. But Pepys famously has this wigs. These periwigs are really, really popular at the time, right? So, and at first he's really like, huh, probably shouldn't get myself a new wig because they're being made from human hair. Probably a lot of that human hair is coming from these dead people who, you know, you can get hair cheap, you know. But his rationale is like, well, I bought a new wig, but I left it in the box long enough. I'm sure it's fine now.
So it's probably fine. It's probably fine. Just wave it through some of that fire.
It's great. I just, you know, his diary is a delight. But yeah, so it's just so interesting that, you know, the 14th century approach, there is a very strongly religious aspect to it. Not that people aren't coming up with folk responses as well. They do. But by the 17th century, the sort of direct controls that they're trying to impose on this are much more, I don't want to say scientific, but they're much more focused on cause and effect. They're much more mechanical than they have been instead of cosmological. So I think that's really an interesting thing. You know, and if you forward that into our 21st century, we've seen people who kind of merge the two of those things, right? Where they'll say like this, you know, this feels like an apocalyptic plague, right? A la The Mummy. But at the same time, you've got people who are doing the scientific, like, oh, you should wash your hands, not touch your face, wear your mask. And then, you know, also make sure that you're eating lots of garlic, right? Eating lots of ginger. And so you've got these kind of interesting kind of folk remedies mingling with the sort of medically prescribed remedies. And I think we'll talk about this, but there's nothing wrong with some of these folk remedies. There's nothing wrong with eating extra garlic.
I mean, you know, if you're on like a date.
Well, it's a pandemic. You want to keep 6 feet away. Garlic is fantastic. Do it.
You know, I was just thinking, I was like, you know, I may not quite know as much as you do about folk remedies, but garlic keeps coming up in like a lot of garlic does like a heavy lifting in like every tradition you've ever heard of. And it's mostly just due to the fact that it's very stinky.
Yeah, it's very pungent. It's funny because like we think of it now as sort of like a panacea in some ways. And at one point in time, like you cooking garlic in your kitchen, if you were an immigrant in the United States, was liable to get people called on, you know, the authorities called on you. So it's a dangerous thing. So I just think that's an interesting thing to see. Now at the same time, you also have literally people saying, please don't inject bleach. So there are folk remedies that we don't want to recommend. And that's important to keep in mind, too.
You know, the interesting thing about talking about, the plague is that, you're right. There's some of the 1300s and it, you know, the Black Death, the plague, the whatever, it doesn't really die out until the 1700s as a disease. Mm-hmm. But what's crazy is that because it happened so long ago, sociologically, historically, we have a better understanding of the impact of that pandemic, which is, I think, why a lot of people talk about it. Mm-hmm. I really enjoyed the reading of James Westfall Thompson, who wrote he was an early American historian and sociologist, pulled up an article of his from the American Journal of Sociology. And you know what's really interesting, and this is wildly insensitive considering the many, many, many millions of people that died. But the thing is, from a sociological perspective, what happens to society isn't the people that die. The people that are affected by this sociologically are the people that survived, mm-hmm. the people that lived. So he wrote this from the American Journal of Sociology way back in, I think, 1921. Mm-hmm. Let us consider the first and most immediate effect, the loss of manpower owing to the great mortality. Mm-hmm. While it's true that the population of Europe is much greater now than in the 14th century and the mortality far higher than in the past 5 years, nevertheless, as everyone knows, the working efficiency of Europe has been seriously reduced owing to the death of large numbers of men in battle or of disease, to which must be added some millions of the civilian population from starvation, privation, and disease. You know, like I said earlier, you know, there's 100 years war going on, and then there's this, you know, giant plague that kills, like you said, somewhere between one third and one half of Europe, depending on which estimates you look at. Mm-hmm. And the crazy thing about it is it's considered one of the best things to have happened to Europe after the fact, because it gave birth to the Renaissance. Mm-hmm. If the Black Plague hadn't happened, the Renaissance wouldn't have happened. But if you look at it from the people that survived, the reduction in the workforce due to those really, really, really astronomically high mortality rates made labor a scarce asset. Mm-hmm. So peasants, you know, us, began to have a certain degree of margin for negotiation. So as their rentals for land grew less costly, leading to an increase in wages. I think that as we continue to talk about some of these pandemics, you're going to see the same things happening over and over and over again. But in certain parts of Europe, rulers took measures to control these increases in salaries and mm-hmm. sparking peasants' revolts in some cases. And most sociologists agree that if you happen to survive the plague, things were actually pretty great for you for quite a long time. The anthropologist Sharon DeWitt of the University of South Carolina says that the entire epidemic, the entire pandemic of the Black Plague, sped up the process of natural selection. So if you survived, she did this really, really cool study where she studied a few hundred skeletons. She went and like examined all the bones. And like I put in my notes here, I said, this is wildly insensitive. Just keep writing. This is wildly insensitive. So I said, while this is wildly insensitive in a modern context, if you lived through the plague, you were far more likely to be healthier, live longer, grow taller, etc. It's even been shown that the immune systems of those that survived the Black Death were so strong that they were resistant to modern diseases like, future callback, HIV/AIDS due to the development of certain genetic alleles. And I can put the source in the show notes because it gives the actual genetic marker that if you have this, you're actually much more likely to be resistant to other diseases like HIV/AIDS. You're not immune. Just saying that. You're not immune. You're just more resistant to it. And DeWitt actually went on to say that because of the Black Death, there was a period of nearly 200 years of just general health and overall increase of survival rates. So, I mean, if you happen to be one of the people that lived through it, you probably made a lot more money. You were able to get a better job. You were able to negotiate that better. You were able to find better, more affordable housing. It's terribly, terribly insensitive, but for the actual people that survived it, life got a lot better after a while in a lot of ways. Plus, of course, culturally, we had the Renaissance. There was art and culture and lots of sex. Yay.
Yes, certainly a lot of naked bodies and paintings, for sure. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I'm not... I think that's an interesting way to look at it. Part of me wonders if there's a little bit of a cart before the horse thing going on there. Not to say that I think that the research there is really, really fascinating, and I would love to see the genetics component of that. But I wonder, like, it certainly prioritizes a certain type of what we would consider success or well-being.
Right.
Because one of the outgrowths of this, like you said, the Renaissance is a part of this. There's also, you know, simultaneously in conjunction with all this, you have, for example, the Reformation, you have the Industrial Revolution going on, you have the growth of a number of new political systems. So, for example, monarchies are being called into question by the end of all this, right? So that's happening as well. And you know, it kind of makes me think, you know, Carol Purcell, who's a material culture historian, has talked a lot about the idea of this mechanical revolution that happened. Mm-hmm. And if you think about, you know, if your labor force dissipates by a third to a half, right?
Yeah.
It's gone. You still need to get a certain amount of labor done.
Yep.
And you're going to try to – humans are really inventive. We're really, really good at adapting to situations. So if you no longer have the five children or farmhands available to help you, all of a sudden maybe you're going to start looking at inventing a thresher, right?
Sure.
And so the mechanical revolution that kind of comes out of this is you know, spurning this industrial revolution, which in turn leads to some other complicated and very negative parts of history too. But it is interesting. Like you do see these plagues. It makes me think. I think there was a Japanese smallpox outbreak, back in the like the 8th or 9th century, maybe. That you know really spurned on a huge shift in the way that government worked for Japan, and the way that a sort of agrarian culture. Moved into a much more sort of hierarchical structure just because they had to be able to deal with, you know, shortages and things like that. And they've, you know, lost like something like 1 million people in this. So you're right. These it's so funny in the darkest gallows humor possible yes, way.
It's terrible. I was like, I didn't think of it this way, but like if you survived.
Right. It revolutionizes everything.
Yes.
So, yeah, it does make you think like what we're going through right now is terrible. It's awful. It's We've got terrible. Half a million people or half a I'm sorry, half a half. Yeah. Half a million people worldwide who have died. That is not a laughing matter.
And, 120,000 of them just in the United States alone.
All kinds of things there. But at the same time, we also are seeing revolutionary momentum building. And I'm not saying that those two things are one causes the other, but there does seem to be correlation. There does seem to be a relationship between the two. And maybe that's something to be watching for as a silver lining somewhere is that there might be a better world on the back end of this. So.
Yeah, the crazy thing, and that's why I wanted to, I think it's good to start with the Black Death, but I also wanted to mention that we have many, many hundreds of years of perspective to see how that particular pandemic played out. And, you know, with some of the much more recent pandemics or panics that we're going to talk about, we don't have those many, many hundreds of years. In fact, the last like two or three that we're going to talk about, we've only been looking at for a few decades. And I think we'd probably both be in agreement. We're still in those. We're still very much in the effects of pretty much everything that's been happening to us since the 80s. So it's interesting to not have that perspective and still try to give commentary on it. But it is good to have a next stop. We were going to talk about Salem next.
Sure.
And the interesting thing to talk about there is that we aren't talking about a pandemic in the sense of a great disease that comes and kills a whole bunch of people. We're talking about social hysteria.
Right. And there, I think we're talking more about what we would consider an epidemic, right? Like this is a localized version as opposed to something that's, although I guess people would certainly argue, you know, witchcraft persecution is a pandemic it's a pandemic of social attitudes in some ways that is carried from the old world to the new. So yeah, we can look at that. I do want to like immediately, you've already established this is a social perspective. There are a lot of people who are probably going to say like, oh, well, you know, there's also a biological perspective to this because there's a theory that floats around out there about ergot poisoning.
I have all of those written down.
Okay. And I will say that is kind of a sketchy support at best in the historical records. And I wouldn't put all my eggs in the ergot basket for why this outbreak happened, because there's so many other factors going on in Salem. But I just wanted to kind of get that out of the way at the beginning. What did you have on ergot there?
No, there have been a lot of people that have tried to give reason. I mean, when terrible things happen, we try to find a reason. Yep. And it's been attributed to everything from what's known as the Little Ice Age to which is probably the most accurate theory, because the Little Ice Age led to a socioeconomic downturn specifically in that area that, you know, again, when earlier man, we're not quite talking about as far back as the Black Plague, but we are talking the 1600s. In fact, I don't think people realize how short of a period of time the Salem witch trials actually was. It's just a little over a year. It was February 1692 to May 1693. So we are talking late 1600s, obviously, but we're only talking about a year, not even a year and a half, just a year and some change. So what's interesting is that, you know, we talk about the Little Ice Age, where we experience lowering of temperatures, and this caused all sorts of issues with shipping and the economy and all sorts of. So there's this cauldron, if you will, of blame to try to throw around as to why people don't have money and why people don't have means, and fingers start getting pointed. But other theories were that there was a fungus to blame, there was encephalitis to blame. There's a lot of people that are trying to point a lot of different kinds of fingers at things. I personally like the socioeconomic theory because I think it makes the most sense.
Sure. Well, and you do see you do see some, I mean, the socioeconomic theory also bears fruit if you're looking at the fact that there's kind of a socioeconomic clash between Salem Town versus Salem Village.
Yes.
A land encroachment issue. There's two kind of distinct families that are warring with each other. The Putnams and the, who are the other ones?
It's very much East Salem and West Salem. I don't know.
Yeah, I'm drawing a blank on the second family. Oh, it's not the Proctors, is it?
It's not the Proctors. Oh my God, there's so many names and so many families with Salem.
Yeah, but at any rate, so it's basically these two really distinct family relationship lines. Those are coming into conflict. So yeah, there's a lot going on there. I'll also say, you know, since we're talking about Salem, it's not coming out of nowhere either.
No.
There are a ton of witchcraft persecutions going on all throughout New England around this time. Mm-hmm. They're just much smaller in scope. Witchcraft is something that people are afraid of from a religious and moral perspective. But there's also, you know, people are actually practicing folk magic at the time. So, for example, one of my favorite people to talk about, and this is a woman named Dorcas Hoare, who literally was, you know, doing fortune telling and doing, sure. She'd been arrested for this, you know, in the 10 years prior to actually being arrested for during the Salem, the one that we think of as the Salem witch trials. So, you know, this stuff is all, it's not popping up out of nowhere. The field is kind of set before we even get into the epidemic happening. Right. So I don't know. You're saying you kind of go for the socioeconomic theory. Why is Salem so ripe at this time for that outbreak?
The book Salem Possessed by Paul mm-hmm. Boyer and Stephen Nissenbaum.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Talk about the fact that there's these, you know, like you were talking about, there's this split between two families. But I look at it from just sort of the larger parts. There's the really agrarian folks in the West, and then there's the very business folks in the East, which are closer to the town. And they said, quote, what was going on was not simply a personal quarrel, an economic dispute, or even a struggle for power, but a mortal conflict involving the very nature of the community itself. The fundamental issue was not who was to control the village, but what its essential character was to be. Mm-hmm. And it's, again, it's really sad how mankind is so predictable. But, you know, whenever there is any kind of economic disparity, when people don't have what they need, when they're, you know, that Maslow's hierarchy of needs, when our base needs aren't being met, or when they're threatened, we, of course, don't look at what we are doing, what we can change. We look at, you know, what's causing this at me? What's mm-hmm. doing this to me? Who's doing this at me? And, you know, basic socio 101, anybody that's taken that first semester course will always bring it back to in-group, out-group dynamics. You are always going to be much more likely to believe the best about the people that look like you, that live next to you, that are mm-hmm. like you, that seemingly hold your values and ideals, and you are immediately going to villainize whatever the other is, whatever mm-hmm. Anybody else that isn't your group, those are bad people. Why? Because they aren't your group. mm-hmm. So, you know, Salem is experiencing this economic turmoil. So what happens? Well, people in the West blame those damn city slickers in the East. Damn mm-hmm. city slickers in the East blame those crazy farmer folks out in the West.
Yeah.
And it leads to, like you were saying, I mean, this isn't the first time that people were accused of witchcraft. It just suddenly, out of the blue, just mm-hmm. turned into this hysteria where, you know, 170-something people were accused. 19 people were killed and two dogs, I think.
And two dogs, yes.
And two dogs. 14 women, 5 men, 2 dogs. You know what I found really interesting, though, in all of this, and I'm sure I'm skipping ahead a little bit, but when I was looking up, I don't think I realized this before I was doing the research for this show. Nobody, with the exception of one person, nobody that confessed to witchcraft died of witchcraft. They were not executed. The only person, the only exception for that that I could find was Samuel Wardwell, who recanted, I guess, like right before he was about to die.
Right. Yeah. He basically thought like, because the precedent had basically been set. Yes. If you can accuse somebody else and admit that you've done it and then recant, you're probably going to get off. And he's kind of like, that didn't happen. So.
I didn't do it. I didn't do it. Yeah. We're not going to still kill me, right?
Yeah.
So, as far as the economics, you know what's crazy is that the only, you know, with the Black Death, the Black Plague, it's easy to see after effects because we're so many hundreds of years out. But we are several hundred years out from the Salem witch trials. And as far as some massive sociological shift, the only thing that I could ever really find about this is that we constantly look to it as like a worst case scenario,
right,
of what hysteria can become.
Oh, it imprinted on the sort of national psyche really, really quickly. I mean, by the 19th century, basically 150 years later, you get one of the descendants of the judges, Nathaniel Hawthorne, writing stories which very much sort of indict the entire Salem phenomenon, because he's sort of bearing this generational guilt over what's happened, you know, when his ancestor was a judge in this specific witch trial. And, you know, and I think it's one of those America as a sort of, you know, European America, basically sort of the Euro inherited America, Anglo inherited America. We love to tell these myths about ourselves, and we have two Puritan myths, right? We have Thanksgiving and we have Salem. And the sort of true story of Thanksgiving can get pretty hairy and gross really quickly. But we gloss that, right? We make it just shiny and polished, and it's all of a sudden about friendship and
corn. Corn's in there.
Yeah, you know, and sharing with the native population. Never mind what's going on, you know, just on the borders, you know, across the town village, or to cross the village lines and things like that. But so that's, you know, one myth we're telling. And then the Salem myth is the myth that we're telling about ourselves, about what happens when we lose sight of reason, right? So we like to imagine ourselves as a nation founded in, you know, staunch Protestant values and sort of Calvinism and good old-fashioned reason. And we say, look, you know, we got so swept up in the Salem thing because we lost control of reason. And I think that's a really interesting way to mythologize our sort of that part of our history. And I also think it's the other thing that I take away from Salem, that I think is, there's a lot to take away from Salem, honestly. But one thing I think is fascinating is how quickly in a crisis we are willing to suspend certain social rules that we had previously been very, very, you know, guarded about. So, for example, with Salem, we have the Court of Oyer and Terminer, which it admits spectral evidence for the first time, right? The idea that you don't actually have to have physical evidence. The fact that your victim is screaming when you touch them proves that you were somehow committing some crime against them, which even the judges involved, I think even Hawthorne himself, John Hawthorne, eventually is like, this seems wrong. Maybe no. You know, and even Cotton Mather kind of in retrospect is going like, yeah, that probably wasn't the best way to handle things. So yeah, you have that kind of happening, that suspension of, you know, essentially kind of a habeas corpus sort of approach to law. And now all of a sudden it's like, well, we're going to take testimony, but we're also going to take invisible testimony as part of the court proceedings. And it's so interesting because
I swear there's a bird and it's looking at me.
Yes. Yeah. Yellow bird. Yeah. Tituba's yellow bird. Right. And it's this yellow bird that is also the devil. And it's terrifying. You know, if you think about, you know, somebody, imagine being the accused in that situation and you're seeing people shrieking in what seems like real physical pain.
Sure.
but that is also being directed at you. I can absolutely imagine at that point, like, what am I doing? Am I doing something the wrong way? And there were people who, like, literally, like, they would be twisting their fingers nervously, right?
Yes.
And all of a sudden somebody would scream and say, like, oh, that's something they're doing witchcraft right now.
Yeah,
they're
twisting. Like breaking my bone. She's twisting my bone. She's – yeah.
And it's just – and the person who's being accused, they're like, well, that's – you know, I'm not trying. You know, that's not what I'm trying to do. I feel like that's wrong. But at some level, they may be internalizing that too, right? So there's this trauma of – like, you know, am I doing this and not if attempting to?
Am I secretly a powerful witch?
Right. And I mean, that relates – there's a lot of old world traditional customs around the evil eye, right, where people can cast the evil eye without trying. They're not trying to cast the evil eye. They just
simply
do.
Simply being jealous, simply being, you know, somebody that looks – that covets thy neighbor's whatever. That in and of itself can curse it in the name of the – which is what was it? Was it the Greeks, Romans that used to have to like you know, mess up their statues, their art or whatever, so that wasn't
right,
like, too beautiful.
It.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Or you put your baby in ugly clothes as a way to counter it. Or
that's
but they
what
also...
I have to do. I have to wear ugly clothes. So
All the time. So much jealousy. You know, but they would even tell people who had that they say this is the, you know, the jettatura, that you know, the person who's ejecting the evil eye venom into the world. Like, if you know that you're the carrier of it, of course, you know, that's bad. But we also sort of recognize that's not really your fault. So just try to make sure you're staring at the end of your nose as much as possible. Right. So we come up with these really interesting solutions to those problems. And in Salem, the solution was, let's suspend law and move into this other space of speculation, literally like spectral speculation, right? So I just think that that's a fascinating thing, and you can see that happening. You know, the idea with you know, our COVID outbreak, right? And this is a real point of contention, right? Like, you know, where are the boundaries of law? People are really, really trying to figure out, like, what can we tell people they have to do within the framework of law versus what are we just saying, please do this thing because it is socially responsible, right? And people could get really up in arms, quite literally up in arms.
Very much so.
Over any perception that their legal rights are being violated in some way. So I don't know. I think we're dealing with that.
I want to bring it back to one of the points that you brought up where, you know, the accused sitting there in the courtroom and going, yeah, I swear I don't have a bird, or I swear I'm not, you know, twisting your bones in my fingers. And I remember, you know, in the documentary Making a Murderer, one of the most powerful statements that gave me this very Oprah aha moment was, you can always be sure that you don't commit a crime. You just simply don't commit a crime. You know, I can make sure I don't murder somebody by not murdering them. But you can never do anything to prevent being accused of a crime. Mm-hmm. There's absolutely nothing that you can do to stop yourself from being accused of committing a crime. And once that accusation is out there, once those once those labels have been applied to you, especially in modern day, whenever news about you know, the accusation can get out and become viral in minutes, literal minutes. Somebody's entire life can be over in just a few hours. The textbook case of that is the woman who got on the plane. What was it, in South Africa? And by the time she landed or something like that, she, like, her life was over. She'd lost her house. She'd lost her job. She had everything. Mm-hmm. But I think it's really interesting because the Black Plague tells us a story of disease, whereas Salem tells us a story of hysteria and paranoia and the dark ways that a disease doesn't have to kill one another, but hysteria can, paranoia can. And I think, you know, in some of these later pandemics, epidemics that we're going to talk about, the issue is that they start those two things combine. themselves and into this really toxic sort of environment that, you know, we're still living in. But I think that it's, you know, people continue to look at Salem, people continue to look at it, not just because, you know, people died and not just because it's witches, but I think it's this horrible cautionary tale, like you said, of everything that can go wrong. It's, they did everything wrong in that instance.
Yeah. Well, and can I flip that around just a little bit too, and also say, like, we're almost saying, you know, these are two different types of epidemics, but fundamentally both of these epidemics are health. Yes. They're different aspects of health. One is a very physical bodily health. One is mental. Yes. And we, I think, you know, had the people, you know, had the Williams, you know, Abigail Williams, and, oh, the rest of the Paris her household,
friends.
Right?
Yeah. Her little yeah. friends.
Had they had their mental health taken a little more seriously, as you know, sort of young developing adolescents, as women in a society where womanhood could sometimes be very, very negatively painted and constricted and constrained, had their mental health been taken more seriously, that might have been a cure for an epidemic right there. So I do I think it's interesting to think about, like, so many of these things that we think of as, you know, hysteria is such an interesting way to think of it, because I think that's an accurate description, but it can almost cover up the idea that there's some mental health components of this that are worth, you know, keeping in mind as we look at other epidemics, because mental health is always a part of any pandemic or epidemic. It's just the part that oftentimes we skip over and don't talk about. So
yeah. we're going to continue talking about another kind of pandemic, and it does have echoes of what happened in Salem, but it didn't end as quickly or as easily, because we dealt with it in the modern age of news cameras and late night reporting and all sorts of things. So we're going to jump forward in time another few hundred years to 1980 and talk about what's known as the Satanic Panic, or Satanic Ritual Abuse. Yeah. So from what I understand, and Corey, help me out here. Let's think of where we were in 1980 here in the United States. We had a period of civil unrest. We are in the 60s and 70s where you know, there's the ideas of free love and hippies and UFOs and the new age and all sorts of things, as far as I think one article that I read about it called it sort of a period of a spiritual vacuum where people were just not really believing in much of anything or believing in a little bit of everything. This book comes out.
Michelle remembers.
Yep. Michelle Remembers, written by Michelle Smith and her husband, the psychiatrist Lawrence Pazder.
Yes. No, hang on. Before you say Michelle and Lawrence Pazder as husband and wife, we need to be very clear. She was his patient before they were married.
Yes.
So there are all kinds of ethical violations happening
there. There are so many problems with this book, with what happened with this book, with all the many, many things. So, but this book comes out in 1980, and it basically documents this terrible, terrible story of child abuse linked to satanic rituals. Why did it do that? Why did this book do that? Well, if you dig a little deeper into the book, the research is very, very bad here. And it has a lot of echoes of what happened in Salem. Michelle comes to the psychiatrist, Lawrence Pazder, and, you know, they're going through all the things that you go through with a therapist. And she says that I have some trauma, but I know I have some trauma, but I can't remember it and I can't tell you. So he does, what was it, like scream therapy? or something like that. He does a scream, and you scream for a really long time, and then you do hypnosis, and there was all of this suggestive language used by Lawrence, and then combine all of those together, and they do this delightful thing where they implant these memories in into Michelle Smith, where she came to believe that she had been ritually abused in for years in this horrible satanic cult. And this book comes out, becomes this huge bestseller. It is read by social workers and basically anybody that cares about kids throughout the country. And suddenly everybody is on the lookout for Satanists, for cultists. And it revives this sort of version of hysteria, of paranoia, of society wanting to believe the worst about one another. And it creates this culture of fear where that had almost endless ripples. We are still very much in this, I would argue. A few years after this book was the McMartin
preschool trial.
Let's see. Let me find my little article here. But what did you? So I know that you talked a lot about satanic panic. What kinds of spiritual things are we talking about here?
I mean, firstly, while I definitely think Michelle remembers is this spark. It's the spark that ignites the powder keg that's waiting to go. I think it's really important to understand there is a very long trail leading to this of gunpowder waiting to go off. And weirdly, so Bill Ellis is one of my favorite sort of researchers, especially in kind of folklore conspiracy theory discussions. He's done a lot of work on the satanic panic. He wrote Lucifer Ascending, which is all about kind of the rise of this theory, these ideas of satanic panic and satanic infiltration and things like that. You know, one of the things that he's pointed out in his work is if you really track back, like you're saying, you know, the 60s and 70s are this sort of free love, open expression of spirituality. There's also a boom in occult interest in the 60s and 70s. We know from our community, this is one of the heydays for Wicca.
The early days of Wicca, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So you've got that, you know, The Exorcist shows up on the scene in 1968, 69. All sorts of, you know, giallo horror films that are in corporate Suspiria, all sorts of films like that are kind of coming out. And even going back further than that, the reason that the occult is taking off, one, you have the specter of World War II, where people witness true atrocities in trying to reconcile those, there are a lot of people kind of turning away from Orthodox religion and looking for other solutions. This happens after the Civil War. This is why, for example, spiritualism takes off after the Civil War, because people are looking for answers outside of traditional religion, and you know, trying to communicate with the sons who went off to war and they never got to see them again, right? So there's a lot of that going on. You also have the rise of the religious right beginning to ferment and rise up starting in the 1920s to 1930s with a couple of sort of evangelical rebirth movements. And crucially, and this is something that Ellis gets into, crucially, you have an internal debate going on within specific evangelical branches, particularly things like Pentecostalism, where some Pentecostal churches are receiving certain spiritual gifts, right? Mm-hmm. They're speaking in tongues. They're receiving messages from the divine. Other Pentecostal churches or other evangelical churches are receiving other spiritual gifts, gifts of prophecy, but maybe visions and dreams, right? Those two things don't always match up. And so to reconcile that, they say, well, when they don't match up, we can either blame each other and thus potentially put ourselves at odds as Christians, or we can say there must be demonic interference. There must be demonic activity going on. Well, how can we explain this, you know, because now there's so many more people experiencing these divine visions, that means that there's a corresponding rise in satanic activity. And so Well, that's the story that's – you see this, like they're circulating – they're literally circulating like audio cassette sermons about this as in a sort of like chainmail phenomenon. People are sending letters out to various branches of their family sharing these stories that are very pseudo early satanic panic feel stories, right? That's happening in the 50s, the 60s, the 70s. So by the time Michelle Remembers is published, the religious right, which is about to come into ascendancy under the presidency of Ronald Reagan, and that's going to have some consequences for another pandemic to talk about. They are primed and ready to believe that, of course, this whole conspiracy of Satanism and global satanic activity, of course, it all makes sense now. All the loose ends come together. Of course, there's an organized group of satanic witches behind all of this.
And you know, it's interesting to continue to look at the echoes of what we're currently going through in the current political sociological period. Just think about what we've heard in the last few years. I mean, Hillary Clinton was allegedly part of a pedophilic ring. Sex cult down in a pizza restaurant.
Yeah.
But the thing is, those kinds of mass hysteria, mental health epidemics have real world consequences. I mean, a guy came in and shot people because he believed that there was a sex cult happening in a basement.
In a restaurant that doesn't have a basement.
Correct.
And a second person showed up again. And later, right? A couple years later, this happened. So, yeah.
It's bizarre because we keep falling into this. Every time we look at it from a historical perspective, we're thinking, oh my gosh, how terrible. Mm-hmm. those dumb people, why would they ever make that mistake? I love and hate that tweet that says that we need to avoid do away with the phrase avoid it like the plague, because it's very clear that we don't avoid plagues,
right?
But what's really interesting about the early birth of this satanic panic is you're absolutely correct. It gives this burgeoning religious right something to latch onto, mm-hmm. and something to make people afraid. Mm-hmm. We were talking briefly earlier, and then I lost my place. But the McMartin case, mm-hmm. which was a case where a preschool director and her son faced 52 counts of molesting their students. Mass hysteria, and none of them got charged. Mm-hmm. There was practically no proof. A January 1990 New York Times article said, quote, "The final leg of a legal marathon that drew national attention not only for its extraordinary length and complexity," it lasted like 10 years, "but also for the difficult questions it raised about the prosecution of child molestation cases, the reliability of children's testimony, and whether the news media stirred emotions with the charges faced." So 1980, Michelle Remembers comes out. 1983, we have this terrible case, which if you're a mom in the Midwest, if you're a mom sort of out there, you're afraid. You think, gosh, well, what is happening to my child? There's got to be something about this. And then, of course, Dungeons and Dragons comes out, gains, fame. And what was it? Bad. I think I've got a note here. Bad pulling. The Bothered About Dungeons and Dragons organization. There it is. 1985, Patricia Pulling joined forces with psychiatrist Thomas Radecki, director of the National Coalition on Television Violence, to create Bad, to tell everybody that Dungeons and Dragons and role-playing games were satanic cult recruitment tools. And of course, heavy metal music, mm-hmm. musicians, and all sorts of other things. They're all there to put you into this satanic cult. What this satanic cult is going to do, I don't really know. Sometimes it sounds kind of fun.
yeah, I mean, to a point, I suppose.
But
sex, drugs, and rock and roll with consent is probably fine.
But the crazy thing, you know, we always hear the terrible gallows humor of "Show me on the doll where the bad man touched you." Sure. But this was created during this time. Mm-hmm. A social worker named Key McFarlane from the Children's Institute International developed a new way to interrogate children with anatomically correct dolls. Mm-hmm. And use them in an effort to assist disclosures of abuse with the McMartin children. After asking the children to point to the places on the dolls where they had allegedly been touched and asking leading questions, McFarlane diagnosed sexual abuse in virtually all of the McMartin children. So we actually have a tool that's still used today. Yeah. It's a good tool. It's a great tool that started as this terrible, terrible thing in the McMartin case. But it's interesting, and I know that that's a lot of verbal soup, but when you look at it with a few decades of perspective, we are very much still in this sort of verbal soup of paranoia when it comes to laying blame on the ills of what's happening in the United States of America, mm-hmm. to an extent around the world, but we're very much in a similar verbal soup. I mean, you know, we all like to share these memes that go around every now and then that are basically just copy pastes of posts by conservative activists, you know, politicians sometimes, conservative thinkers, religious folks on the right. Who just sort of throw this kind of verbal soup at you anytime there's a bad thing that happens or something that they consider a bad thing. You know, gay marriage is this cult and we're going to induct your children, and there's Satanism and Wicca and witchcraft, and you know, there's that guy with the sign. He's like, sign.
Nope, I know that guy.
Your children are being inducted, and it's mm-hmm. Satanism and I don't know, nail polish and McDonald's, whatever. All the bad things. But it's interesting looking at the satanic panic, because I don't think that, you know, like the Black Plague, like Salem, I don't think we've reached the end of it. I think that we're very much still in this time. I remember Harry Potter was mm-hmm. sort of a resurgence of this. My own mother came in and asked me whether or not I should be reading these books, because don't they want to induct me into a terrible, terrible witch cult? And as we both know, that discussion worked, because I'm very much a Christian now.
Yeah.
No, go ahead.
I was going to say, it just reminds me, I have a friend who whose dad showed him Rocky Horror Picture Show as a adolescent, because he was hoping that it would make him see how ridiculous, you know, being gay or in any way affiliated with any aspect of LGBTQ identity was. And instead, like, that guy has gone on to like be part of live Rocky Horror shows and stuff like that. Like, parents, that's not the method. Don't do that.
Or
don't do it at all. You shouldn't be doing it.
Well, I mean, I'm going to get a lot of hate for this, but Rocky Horror is a terrible, movie.
It's intentionally terrible. Yeah.
It's a terrible movie. I've tried to sit through that movie probably three times. I know that's not a lot, but it's probably three times too many. And I will tell you that I find the first 30 minutes entertaining every time. And then after that, I keep thinking, why did we have to keep going? But I also think that about Monty Python and the Holy Grail, which is
It may just not be, you know, it's not for everybody. It's not everybody's kind of humor. So, but that's a total tangent.
You're right, Corey. It's a weird tangent. It's probably a good place to stop. I don't know. There's no good place to stop. It's a really long episode. We had a really long conversation. So I hope that you guys enjoyed part one of this two-part episode, inciting a pandemic riot. Thank you so much to my dear friend Corey Hutchison of New World Witchery. If you are not already subscribed to New World Witchery, what the heck are you doing with your life? Come on now. Like, go do it. Go do it right now.
Notes are going to be at incitingariot.com. You can find everything about Corey there, as well as a list of the resources used in the making of this show. Part two is going to include the rest of the Satanic Panic discussion from the 80s, as well as getting into things like the HIV/AIDS panic, Ebola, H1N1, and a few other things, including just sort of modern day talk about the coronavirus. So fun times. There's about another hour worth of audio, so part two will be coming later on this month. However, if you are a Patreon supporter, you already know what's coming because you have already gotten access to the full video and audio versions of this show, all 2 hours and 20 minutes of it. If you would like to become a supporter, you can give as little as a dollar a month at patreon.com/incitingprojects. Once again, notes, blogs, all sorts of fun things are at my website, incitingariot.com. You can email me, Firelight, F-I-R-E-L-Y-T-E, at incitingariot.com. Or if you can't remember that, there's a contact button form thing on the website. You can find me on pretty much every form of social media at Inciting a Riot. It's on the Facebook and the Insta and the Twitter and all the things. So just find me wherever it's posting all the things. So anyways, thank you guys so much for tuning in. I look forward to bringing you part two of this discussion soon, but that means it's over for today. I'm going to leave you. But as always, I will leave you with love and light, Firelight.